Pat. I think we'll take a poll here. I've been worried about the undecided vote because someone has commented that Carter may get it all because he's so undecided himself. So I want to say, first of all, that I'm very pleased to be here with my good friend, as he said, for 25 years. I hate to think it's been that long, Rex, but I guess it has. We were both 18 at the time, and but with both of us gone from Russell County, you can imagine the shape they're in. They're a lot better off. But it is good to be here, and I'm sorry I missed the panel that preceded my comments, because I understand they didn't reach any conclusion either. The point is that no one knows what will happen on November 2nd, because everything is sort of up in the air, and I don't want to talk about that particularly, but I do want to suggest that pineapple juice is better for you than peanut butter. For one thing, it doesn't stick to the roof of your mouth. I guess I'm the only one of the four candidates talking with the bankers and their wives, and I'm very proud and honored to do this. I've never had bankers stand up to me before. That's a new experience. Generally been the other way around. Just before I went to my knees, I stood up. But I'm glad to see a softening up in the banking community. But I am honored to be here, and I say that total candor. We've been in 35 states, or I've been in 35 states, and the president is just cranking up. And maybe I can crank down or unwind, but we have been in 35 states participating in this great American experience called the presidential election or Campaign 76 or whatever. And I find the experience to be interesting, sometimes exhausting, but at all times exciting. And above and beyond that, I can't think of a more important time in America or a greater time to be involved in this experience. I've said, many people ask how I got on the ticket, and that's being asked with more and more frequency as we get nearer and nearer the election. And I tell them back on August 19th, as we turned in that early morning newscast, the commentator was saying that it was down to four names, and whoever might be selected by the president would have to be there in Kansas City by 12 o'clock for a joint press conference. And so the first name mentioned was Ann Armstrong. I knew she was over in Scotland. Didn't see how she could get back, so I scratched her off the list. The second name was Bill Ruckelshaus, a great Republican from the state of Indiana. He was in Tacoma, Washington. Besides, I thought his name was too long for a button, so we scratched him off. And that left Senator Baker and Senator Dole, and I told my wife, I said, if they don't go in alphabetical order, I think we've got a chance. So they had some high-powered system. Someone said they flipped a coin, and it didn't come down. They decided to take me. But for whatever reason, shortly after that, the press started gathering in the corridor on the 17th floor of the Muehlbach Hotel. And our room was right next to the suite occupied by John Connally. And so after about 30 or 40 minutes of curiosity, I told Elizabeth to go to the door and put her ear down and see what she could hear. That's legal in Kansas City. That is, if you listen from the inside out. Now, I don't know about the other, but so she heard the name Dole mentioned, and we didn't know whether they were drinking pineapple juice or making an application for relief. But in any event, because of the proximity of the room to Governor Connally, when the president called, I accepted before I identified myself, thinking he might have the wrong number. And so that's sort of how it all started. And it's been an experience ever since that time. Now, I assume anybody coming before the bankers' convention should discuss economic policy. But I don't intend to do that. I thought I might discuss, because there's a great deal of interest in the presidential debates, as there should be a great deal of interest. And I think the last debate, both Governor Carter and President Ford did quite well. I think one, of course, did better than the other, but they both showed up and both gave us their views. And, of course, we're going to have another debate on Wednesday night, and that debate's going to center on foreign policy. So I thought I might discuss foreign policy in very limited aspects as I see it, as I see Governor Carter's stance on foreign policy, and as I see President Ford's stance on foreign policy. I might say, as I stand here, the last time I had the privilege of speaking in Constitution Hall, we were expressing our concern for America's POWs and those missing in action in Southeast Asia. And we filled the hall that night on somewhat of a challenge, because I had attended a meeting about 4 or 5 months earlier when 170-some people showed up concerned about the plight of Americans. Of course, there's been a great deal of talk in recent weeks about amnesty and blanket pardons and whatever. And I don't want to get off the base, but it just seems to me, as I stand in this hall, I should repeat what I've said. And I know there are very serious problems, but it seems to me that the American people have to have our priorities straight, and I'm going to concern myself with those hundreds and hundreds of missing in action in Southeast Asia, some of whom may be alive. And I'm going to concern myself with those forgotten Americans before I get too concerned about those who forgot America. And that's really what it's all about. Although it seems to me Mr. Carter's policy, not to inform us fully about his policies, he has said enough during the campaign to convince me that there are some very distinct differences between the policy views, foreign policy views of Governor Carter and the foreign policy views of President Ford. I think first among Mr. Carter's principles seems to be the idea that Congress should participate to a greater extent in the formation and implementation of foreign policy. Now, I've always thought, I've been in the Congress for 16 years, that we had a pretty good input into foreign policy. A lot of it we shoved off on the president, whether he was a Democrat or Republican, when we didn't want to make the tough decisions. But, of course, the Constitution gives the Congress the power to declare war. The Senate, of course, has the power to confirm the appointment of ambassadors, consent to treaties, and pass upon the qualifications of the nation's major foreign and defense policy officials. In addition, we have all the appropriations and all the committees that deal with foreign policy matters. So I would guess that Congress has a great deal of input, or could have a great deal of input. And leaving aside, of course, the fact that Congress is controlled by members of Governor Carter's party, Mr. Carter's desire to provide Congress with further authority ignores a congressional record which might charitably be called dismal. We only have to look at the record of Congress in foreign policy to question Mr. Carter's approach. It was Congress that cut off aid to Turkey, one of our strongest NATO allies. It was Congress that cut off aid to Angola and opened the door to Cuban intervention. It was Congress that nearly destroyed our intelligence sources with its clumsy, leaky investigation of the CIA. If you want to go back a few years, it was Congress that passed the Gulf of Tonkin Resolution. It sort of set the stage for the great tragedy in Southeast Asia. And I might add as an aside, it was this senator standing here who offered the amendment to repeal the Gulf of Tonkin Resolution, much to the chagrin of Senator Fulbright, who said I couldn't do that because I hadn't been there long enough. But it was done. Not because we had any quarrel with Senator Fulbright, but because I hadn't heard at that time that I had declared for Senator Fulbright. And so the indication is that Congress has acted. And we've acted more than once, and many times responsibly, but many times not totally responsibly. And second among Mr. Carter's principles is what he is pleased to call openness. The opposite of openness, in Mr. Carter's view, are the negotiations conducted by our Secretary of State with the heads of governments and foreign ministers. These he calls, and these he indicates, are, quote, secret. Now, Mr. Carter must know that negotiations among nations require a great deal of discretion. There should be little need for any negotiation at all if each party knew exactly what the other wanted. They knew what they wanted, knew what they had, what they were willing to sacrifice, and what they might be determined to fight for, then you wouldn't have to have any negotiations. You wouldn't have any collective bargaining negotiations. You wouldn't need any negotiations of any kind. And these things cannot often be stated in the public as well or as candidly as they can be stated in private. So Mr. Carter pays lip service to openness and condemns secrecy. But at the same time, he says that he would conduct unpublicized, that's his word, unpublicized negotiations with the Soviets over the Middle East. Now, this doesn't sound to me like a victory for openness. At least Secretary Kissinger's negotiations are publicized. Now, there are other elements of Mr. Carter's foreign and defense policy views that baffle me. He says, and I quote, "We must replace balance of power politics with world order politics." Let me repeat, balance of power politics must be replaced with world order politics. And it's hard to decipher this slogan, but we are intended to get the idea that in a Carter administration, there would be less emphasis on military strength. Now, we've had two world wars in this century and two costly localized wars, and I might suggest all under Democrats, in a large part because other nations did not believe America had the strength or the will to wage war. And nothing invites war like weakness. And we had peace under President Eisenhower because foreign powers were convinced, and they knew, that we had both the strength and the will to wage war if necessary. And one of the longest periods of peace in the last two centuries came from the effective balancing of power worked out under Metternich at the Congress of Vienna in 1815. What all this means is that in relations among nations, power and order are not alternatives, as Mr. Carter seems to believe. Rather, world order flows from an effective use of power by men, yes, and by nations of goodwill, whose goal is world peace. And if we can achieve that kind of balance of power that preserves the world peace and permits us to devote our resources to solving the problems of poverty, population, environmental pollution, and hundreds of other things, that will be already enough for me, and I think for most Americans. Yet Mr. Carter does not seem to understand this concept. In 1972, he said we shouldn't cut the defense budget. In 1975, he said we ought to cut it $15 billion. In 1976, he said we ought to cut it $5 to $7 billion. And he says that time after time after time, along with his comments about reducing unemployment, stopping inflation, balancing the budget, and giving you a lot of new programs. But he persists in this debate about our defense posture. And I would suggest that even the Brookings Institution, on whom Mr. Carter relies for foreign and defense policy advice, has noted, and I quote, "The process of reducing the U.S. share of resources devoted to defense has more or less run its course. Military power continues to play an important part in world affairs. The nation can only protect itself and its interests abroad, but is willing to maintain a credible military posture." That's not my statement, not President Ford's statement, not Senator Mondale's statement. It's a statement from the Brookings Institution. And I think that's all the more reason. And there are many, many reasons, but this is one significant and important reason, that we need a wise and experienced and a tough president in the White House to reduce this temptation, whatever that temptation may be, and whenever it may come, the temptation which any foreign power might have to test our will. And the last time a major foreign power doubted the strength of an American president, we got the Berlin Wall and the Cuban Missile Crisis. But if Mr. Carter is less than reassuring on the question of maintaining our defense posture, it is downright frightening in discussing how you might use them, and let me just spend a minute or two on that. In discussing the use of nuclear weapons, he said, he would use them only if he was, quote, convinced the security or existence of our nation was threatened. The limiting words "our nation" naturally created anxiety among our allies around the world. Then to prove he had thought it all out very carefully, he said, and I quote, the use of atomic weapons in Europe would certainly not be contemplated by me without agreement of the nations who would be most directly affected by retaliatory actions against the Soviet Union. And he went on to say, I certainly couldn't imagine using nuclear weapons in Europe without Germany and Austria and perhaps France approving their use. Now, I just asked the question, who can make sense of this? Is he really saying that in the midst of a crisis severe enough to warrant the use of nuclear weapons in Europe, by which he must mean an attack against our NATO allies, that he would take time out for consultation? Now, these are expressions which weaken the credibility of our nuclear deterrent, and I'm certain our allies would prefer to have an American president move decisively to implement our agreed strategy of flexible response than to have somebody stop and discuss in the height of a nuclear confrontation if that terrible day should ever arrive. And while we're on the subject of weakness, and while we're on the subject of credibility, I think we should consider Mr. Carter's statement about communists in the Italian government. The question, quite simply, is whether Italy can be permitted to remain as a full member of NATO if communists hold posts of major responsibility in its government. President Ford and Secretary Kissinger have taken the position that such a communist role would raise questions about Italy's role in the NATO alliance. But Mr. Carter is a good deal less clear, and his message is getting across. In May, Mr. Carter told an interviewer, I believe we should support strongly the democratic forces in Italy, but still we should not close the doors to communist leaders in Italy for friendship with us. In June, before the Italian elections, Enrico Berlinguer, the leader of the Italian Communist Party, welcomed these remarks by saying, and these are his remarks, not mine, there have been statements by some American leaders containing veiled threats. But others, including presidential hopefuls from the Democratic Party, said although they don't like the idea of our participation in the government, this should be viewed with relative equanimity. And Mr. Carter has persisted in this vein, telling an interview in August that he could live with communists in the Italian government. I wouldn't see it, he said, as a catastrophe or a cause for destruction of the NATO alliance. And I say language of this kind can only signal our allies that in the event of Mr. Carter's election, the United States would be less than firm in its opposition to communist participation in the Italian government. And then in contrast to the weakness, uncertainty and confusion of Mr. Carter's position on defense and on foreign policy matters, we have the record of President Ford. And let me say that first, I think it's well worth noting. I think most everyone in this audience understands how important experience is and how important leadership is. President Ford is thoroughly grounded in the matters of defense and foreign policy. He spent 14 years in the Congress on the Defense Appropriations Subcommittee. Through patience and firmness, he has managed for the first time in 10 years to bring about real growth in the funds appropriated by Congress for defense, and that's this year. Now, this is not a desire, I might add, to spend money just for the sake of spending money, but rather to keep this country strong for the sake of peace. As I've said time and time again, and not in a partisan sense, but I've explain my own feelings. It seems to me, as a Midwesterner, as an American, as someone who's had some experience on both sides of armed conflict, it's going to be rather difficult for America to sit down with some other superpower if we're number two. And I think we have an obligation not just to American generations to come, but all generations to come who love freedom in this world, to remain number one for the sake of peace. I don't want to be number two. And we can save billions and billions of dollars. And we've made savings in defense. It's time we looked at everything. But we can't have it both ways. If you really want to save in defense, take out $20, $30, $40 billion and put all that money in so-called social programs. But it doesn't do us much good to have great social programs and lose our liberty and freedom in the process and take a step backward in world leadership. And that's what it's all about. And again, I would quote the Brookings Institution, not known for its strong defense or conservative views. And here's what they say. The nation can only protect itself and its interests abroad if it is willing to maintain a credible military posture. If it does so, perhaps its adversaries will come to understand that the wisest course is to mutually reduce armaments and develop the necessary framework for more cooperative relations. Then, but only then, could the cost of defense safely renew its decline. And I would just say that President Ford's experience goes beyond the Congress, beyond the vice presidency, includes the presidency itself. He has been to the summit a number of times. He's been there to reassure our allies and our potential adversaries that discontent in American democracy does not mean disarray in the Western alliance. Today our word is trusted, our will is not doubted, and our credibility is undiminished. And we are at peace. And I say, oh, yes, I'm biased and prejudiced. But I say, notwithstanding my bias and prejudice, that we have President Ford to thank for that, because we are at peace. The President has had more than 120 meetings with foreign leaders, and he's visited some 14 foreign countries. Our alliance has never been stronger. And this is a record of an active President in foreign affairs. And under President Ford, the Middle East achieved a new and significant milestone in the Sinai Agreement of 1975. It is the first agreement, the very first agreement. There has not been the result of direct hostilities. Both Israel and Egypt have called it a turning point in the search for peaceful settlement in the Mideast. And you can look at the Vladivostok Agreement, the fact that President Ford is the first American president to visit Japan, reaffirming this nation's commitment to the security and well-being of Asia in the wake of the Indochina conflict. And President Ford has sent his Secretary of State to Africa to prevent bloodshed, to protect minority rights, to forestall increased Soviet influence, and to achieve peaceful, democratic solutions to the racial conflicts which threaten peace in that continent. And at the bottom line, in the last analysis or whatever, President Ford's strength in the area of foreign affairs and defense policy resides in the fact that he knows what he's doing. Our own people and foreign leaders know what President is doing and know what he will do. He's predictable. He's dependable. And all are confident that he is equal to the job. And I would like to close on that note with an observation that statecraft and mystery do not mix. No small part of the peace of the world rests upon the fact that key world leaders know each other, understand each other, and respect each other, no matter how much they may disagree and oppose each other. And for that reason, I can tell you that nothing in this campaign has been more disturbing to me than the largely overlooked words of Mr. Carter's campaign manager and advisor, Hamilton Jordan. Alongside the interview which Mr. Carter gave in Playboy magazine, which many are waiting with anticipation for various reasons, but alongside that interview in Playboy, Mr. Jordan had this to say. If after the inauguration you find Cy Vance as Secretary of State and Brzezinski as head of national security, then I would say we failed and I'd quit. Now, these are his words. He went on to say, but that's not going to happen. You're going to see new faces and new ideas. And these are his words, and they startled me a little. He said, the government is going to be run by people you've never heard of. You may have a chance. If you hold up your hand, we'll pass through the room. Now, that statement reflects to me cynicism rather than high order. It tells us that Mr. Carter's assembled his policy advisors not for their experience and skills, but solely for the purpose of lending much-needed credibility to his candidacy. And I assume that's why Mr. Schlesing was there yesterday. And that's why his picture was in the paper, and that's why he was on television. Not for what he might tell Mr. Carter, but to give him some credibility in foreign affairs. And if he should be elected, these advisors and the wisdom and experience they could bring to the conduct of Mr. Carter's foreign policy would be dismissed. Now, on the other hand, if Mr. Carter had shown some grasp of foreign policy and defense matters, I would not be so concerned, but he has not. Instead, he has left us all wondering about where he really would lead this nation if he had a chance. Now, I don't know what farmers call that, but I know what bankers call it, but farmers call it a pig in the poke. And we don't like a pig in the poke. I think the world is too dangerous to let this happen. But I think whatever else we may agree or disagree on, we all recognize that the world, with all its opportunities for progress, prosperity, and peace, also confronts us with perils and uncertainties. And if we're going to preserve that peace, we've got to have the wise and seasoned and trusted and perceptive leadership. And that's why I'm pleased to be here today to indicate to you in the most candid way I can, without any personal attacks on the other candidates, that we have such a man. We have such a man. We've had such a man for the past 2 years. And we have a man who all the surveys indicate won the first debate hands down because he showed the confidence and the competence and projected that leadership that America needs so badly. And I say to my Democrat friends and my independent friends, party labels at this point sort of take a back seat. We're looking for leadership. There's going to be another debate on Wednesday night on foreign policy, and I ask you to watch. We make mistakes. We're not perfect. We haven't said, and I might add this just as an aside in a domestic matter, as he said in an Associated Press interview talking about tax reform, that he would tax all income alike. That ought to make businessmen shudder. It ought to make you wonder. And I just say it's too important to be swept aside. It's too important to stand up before anyone and say, I don't want to make a partisan speech. I want you to all go out here not knowing anything about my views or anything about the other side's views. So it's been a great honor and a great privilege. Next, I think maybe a week from Friday, Senator Mondale and myself will be debating. That's high school football night. You'll probably all be watching the football game. I haven't chosen my makeup man, but his will be George Meany, I guess. And I would just close with one mild admonition. The election is lost on November 2nd. It will be because a great many Americans, men and women, young and old, black and white, Spanish-speaking, whatever, who had pretty much the same philosophy, didn't do anything about it. They stayed home. They talked about free enterprise in the closet and put all the emphasis on the word free. And if you have a philosophy, a moderate to conservative philosophy, you have an obligation to help that philosophy. So I would just hope that in the next 30 days or 29 days, whatever it is, that you take a hard look and then make the choice for America. That's what it's all about. Thank you very much.
Over. Over a little further for full television.
Well, that's it. That's it. Good. Now you're right. Well, we're glad, happy to be in Virginia. This is, I think, our 34th or 35th state. We're going to carry the state of Virginia. President Ford is coming on strong, and there's a great deal of movement in this campaign. And this is one we're going to have.
What kind of repercussions have you felt from the Earl Butts affair?
I haven't felt any.
It's from a farm state. What kind of damage do you think this will do with the farmers?
I think in some areas, of course, where Secretary Butts had personal friends, there may be some reluctance for a day or two.
Just for a day or two?
I think what the farmers are really concerned about are the thrust of our programs, and we're moving in the right direction. And I would hope that President Ford can name someone as acting Secretary of Agriculture soon who would identify with the farmers. And beyond that, I don't see any repercussions.
Jimmy Carter has accused the president of lack of leadership in not firing Butts as soon as the disclosure was made. Do you have any agreement with that at all? Do you think Butts should have been fired, or do you think Ford was right to wait for him to resign?
Carter wouldn't recognize leadership if he met it head on. I don't know how you can criticize President Ford. Maybe you ought to take a look at his campaign. Maybe he should step aside as Secretary Butts did after his remarks in Playboy and Norman Mailer. That would be real leadership.
What's the purpose of debating with Mondale?
That's a good question.
Would you just as soon not debate?
Well, I don't think we're going to set the world on fire. In fact, I hope someone will tune in. I understand they're getting near a time and a place and a date, maybe Houston, Texas. But let's face it, we're each number two on the ticket, and we can't go around making policy. I assume it'll sort of be a sparring match for 75 minutes, and those who aren't attending high school football games and can't get anything else on their set may be watching.
Isn't the public paying more attention to who the vice presidents are now than
citizens? Oh, I think so. I think, you know, with the electronic media, if you are out occasionally, people know who you are. I think there is more attention focused on the vice presidential candidates, yes, but I don't really believe that people look to us for policy decisions. I would hope they look at the number one man on the ticket, either Carter or Ford.
What would you consider the major issue between you and
I think philosophical. I think we both like each other, but we have almost totally different views on our philosophy. He thinks that government can do everything, and I think for the most part, we leave that to the individual. He's a very good spokesman for organized labor in the Congress. He's got 100% or 95% labor rating. I have about a 7. He's got about a 4% or 5% conservative rating. I have an overall average of 70-some. So there's enough difference there to drive a pretty good truck through. Thank you.
Thank you very much. It's great to be back in Blacksburg, especially as a carefree graduate rather than a test-fearing student, I'll tell you that. And in my 4 years at BPI, I had some wonderful times. I met some great friends, enjoyed the beautiful countryside, broadened my social life, and I also got a good education. Seriously, though, I do feel that I learned a great deal while I was attending school here, and one person who is partially responsible and does deserve mention here, a great professor and a good friend, is Dr. Johnson in the psychology department. Okay, more serious things here. Not only as the vice presidential candidate's daughter, but as an interested and a concerned young person, I feel that this election is a very important one for all of us. I urge you to read both platforms thoroughly, listen to the candidates, and study the facts. And I have no doubt that after weighing the two sides, you will find, as I have, that President Ford and my father, Senator Dole, will provide the strongest leadership for our country for the next 4 years. So I strongly urge... Thank you. And in closing, I'd just like to urge you to get out to the polls and vote for Ford and Dole on November 2nd. Thank you very much.
Thank you very much, and I Of course, I want to acknowledge my daughter's presence. I knew she was broadening something in Virginia Tech, and this morning she confessed it was her social life, so I'm very happy to know that she had a great time here. She said coming in she had seen a lot of these policemen, never been escorted into town before. I think been chased out a few times, but... And I can tell you that she was petrified standing before this audience of her peers, and I thought she did a very good job, and I'm very proud of her. I didn't write it. She wrote it on the way this morning, and it indicates that when you have to get up and say something, really not so bad when it's over. It's like going to the dentist. Let me say, first of all, that I'm pleased to be here, of course, with Lieutenant Governor Dalt and my good friend Bill Wampler. Bill and I served together in the House. We're both on the House Agriculture Committee. When I went to the Senate, Bill Wampler moved up on the Agriculture Committee, and of course, as you know, is now the ranking Republican on the House Committee on Agriculture. We've been very close friends, and we think pretty much alike. I believe we vote pretty much alike. I believe we're concerned about America, concerned about America's future, concerned about America's young people. So I, too, am pleased to be here at the greatest land-grant college in America. I'll take Bill's word for it. He understands it. I'm also very proud to be invited to speak here. I understand that all the major candidates were invited. We are permitted to make political statements. I'll try to confine my statements to the truth, and you can sort them out as you will. I want to say first off that pineapple juice is a lot better for you than peanut butter. For one thing, it doesn't stick to the roof of your mouth, but there are probably many other good reasons. I think it might be of interest to young people who are thinking about a career in politics to... Not so much how I got into politics, but just as one person in politics. When I first went to Congress back in 1961 in the House of Representatives, I represented a Western Kansas district with 26 counties at that time, later 58 counties, a very rural district. And as Bill Wampler knows, when you go to Congress as a freshman, you're sent out to speak. Or at least you're asked to go to speak, and most freshman members of Congress think the next step's the White House, so they're very eager to go out and broaden their base and broaden their contacts. And so I was sent to Indiana, and they used to send me to very safe districts where I couldn't do any damage, either safe Republican or safe Democrat districts. So I was going out to speak at a fundraiser on a Saturday evening, and I arrived that afternoon. And the frustrated and confused and disturbed county chairman met me at the airport, and he said, we're glad you're here. The advance ticket sale has already reached 10. So he was deeply disturbed and rushed me to the radio station, and we were interviewed. And we went through the normal things that I was born and other necessary things to get into any, even politics, you have to be born. And that I was raised in Kansas and all that, and he said that I'd been injured in the war, and went on and on. And as we left the station to go back to the place we were speaking that night, he was summarizing the interview, and he said, Congressman Bob Dole will speak tonight at 7:30, and said he was born in Kansas, raised in Kansas. Said prior to World War II, he was a pre-medical student. He suffered a serious head injury in the war, and then went into politics. So I don't know. I don't know how you got where you are, but I know how I got where I am. Many people ask, and I've been saying, I hope in jest, with more frequency in more recent days, Senator, how did you get on the ticket? And I'll just say very quickly that the morning of August 19th, it was reported that the selection were down to four. There were still four Republicans being considered by President Ford, and whoever was selected had to meet with the president and show up at a joint press conference at noon. This was about 8 o'clock in the morning when we heard we're down to four. The first was Ann Armstrong, and she was over in Scotland. I knew she couldn't get back by noon, so we scratched her off the list. The next was Bill Ruckelshaus, an outstanding Republican from the state of Indiana. He was out in Tacoma, Washington, a long way from Kansas City. Besides, his name is too long for a button, so we scratched him off the list. And that left Senator Baker and Senator Dole, and I told my wife, I said, if they don't go in alphabetical order, I think we've got a chance. And so as the time passed on that morning, the press started gathering out in our corridor. But I didn't think it was for my purpose, because our room was right next to the suite occupied by Governor Connally of Texas, and I presumed that he'd probably gotten the nod and he was going to be marching out to meet the press and go see the president. But after about 30 or 40 minutes, my curiosity got the best of me, and I told my wife, Elizabeth, I said, go to the door and put your ear down and listen. That's legal in Kansas City if you listen from the inside out. It's only when you do the other that you have problems. And she heard the name Dole mentioned. We didn't know whether they were talking about pineapple juice or somebody was applying for relief or what, but in any event, we got ready. And just because of the uncertainty and because of my proximity to Governor Connally's suite, when the president called, I accepted before I identified myself, thinking he might have gotten the wrong number. And so the campaign's been going ever since, and we've now been in 34 or 35 states. It's been a great experience. We've made mistakes. I assume the other side has made mistakes. They made theirs right off the bat, nominating Carter. And I listened to Governor Carter last night criticizing President Ford for lack of leadership in handling the matter with Secretary Butts. Well, my answer to that is that Carter wouldn't recognize leadership if he met it head on. He doesn't know what the word means. He doesn't have the experience. And let me tell you why. Because we're engaged in a very important contest. We're talking about the leadership of the most powerful free world or free country in the world. It's very important. And young Americans have a very vital stake in what happens on November 2nd. And I know that most Americans haven't read the platform. I know that most Americans are not going to read the platform of the Republican Party or the other party. I think they should. I think you would find a vast difference, as Governor Reagan said in a half-hour program a couple of weeks ago. I know and I hope and I trust that I'm talking with Republicans, yes, and independents, yes, and Democrats in this audience, and some who may be totally uncommitted, undecided, or just plain came to the wrong meeting. Because it's very, very important. As I said, we're not perfect. And I assume you could take my voting record, you could take President Ford's voting record, and you would find mistakes. You would find disagreements. But I've known President Ford for 16 years in the Congress. We're never close personal friends on a social basis, but we work together in the Congress. And as someone said recently, whether President Ford wins or loses, he's still the same Jerry Ford that walked into the White House over 2 years ago in a time of national concern and national tragedy and picked up the reins and restored confidence and integrity in the White House. He's bringing about prosperity and has maintained peace. But beyond that, I think it's almost important to young Americans and all Americans. What kind of a man is he? What kind of a person is President Ford? Well, you needn't take my word for it. You can ask almost anyone who's had contact with President Ford, again, whether he's a Democrat or a Republican or an independent. They all say the same thing. He's decent. He's open. He's candid. He's competent. And he projects that leadership that America so badly needs in the next 4 years. And so I say on the plus side, we have a man with experience. We have a man of decency. We have a man of integrity. And he does exude that confidence, and he does provide that leadership. I had the privilege yesterday of speaking with a group of bankers from across America. I didn't know their politics. I assumed some were Republicans, some were Democrats. And I talked about foreign affairs. And if any group ought to be interested in foreign affairs, it ought to be the group here today. Now, some of us have gone through some of the tragedies of war. We understand firsthand or secondhand what it means on a personal basis. We understand the agonies. Oh, yes, in World War I and World War II and Korea and most recently Vietnam. We also understand the need for America to be strong and maybe more fully understand it for that reason. Now, I know young Americans don't want to fritter away your tax money or anyone's tax money on wasteful, needless programs. But I've got a sort of a gut feeling that if we're going to sit down with the superpowers, whether it be Russia, China, or whoever, we must sit down and we must deal from a position of strength. I don't want to be number two in the world. I want to be number one for the sake of peace. And that's what it's all about, for the sake of peace. Not because I have any aggressive tendencies. I don't want any more conflicts involving America's young people. Back in 1972, Governor Carter said it would be a tragedy, and these are his words, or paraphrased, to cut America's defense budget. Now, he wasn't running for president then. That's what he said in 1972. George McGovern was running. And McGovern was saying we ought to cut defense, and we ought to cut defense. Oh, not Governor Carter. It would be a mistake. But then he started running for president a couple years ago. In 1975, he said, we ought to cut defense $15 billion. $15 billion. And that's a right he has to say that. This year, he's saying we ought to cut it $5 to $7 billion. Well, let me say, I'm a member of the Budget Committee, along with Senator Mondale. I'm a member of the Finance Committee, along with Senator Mondale. We understand the many burdens and pressures and pulls and tugs on the budget. Everyone wants more money. But the Congress, in its lack of wisdom in the past 6 to 8 years, has cut $30 to $40 billion in the defense budget. And this year, for the first time, and because of the personal efforts and personal persuasion of President Ford, we've restored some real growth in the defense budget. Now, let me underscore and reemphasize. We're not talking about just spending money for spending money's sake. We're talking about the role of America. I don't think we can take two steps backward. I don't think we can afford to be in second place. Because whether we like it or not, we are the leader of the free world. And whether we like it or not, enslaved people around the world and others who seek liberty and freedom consider us not only their best, but in many cases their only hope. And that's the responsibility that Americans have, young Americans, old Americans, black, white, Spanish-speaking, rich or poor. It's an American responsibility. It's something we don't take lightly. And all I've asked, and I've asked it a number of times, Oh, yes, Governor Carter, we want to save money. Just tell us how you're going to cut $5 to $7 billion in defense. And mind you, he's saying this at the very time Secretary of Defense Donald Rumsfeld is saying that just to keep pace with the Russians, we may have to spend $18 to $20 billion more. Not cuts, but more. And I think young Americans ought to take a cold, hard look. Because if there is a conflict, if there is a problem, if there is a threat, it's not going to be President Ford who suits up. It's not going to be Governor Carter who puts on a uniform, or Bob Dole or Walter Mondale. Our generation is gone. It's going to be your generation. And you're going to be asked to stand up for America. And that's fine. We ought to stand up for America when America's right. We ought to stand up for America now and make certain America's so strong you not have to stand up and march off to war somewhere next year or next year or the next year. And that's really what it's all about. You know, President Ford has visited some 14 foreign countries. He's met with 120 foreign leaders. People respect President Ford. Foreign leaders respect President Ford. They know where he stands. They know he's predictable. They know he's dependable. And then, yes, Governor Carter runs around the country saying President Ford is insensitive. President Ford lacks compassion. He said former President Johnson was a liar and a cheat and distorted the facts. He clamored for Butts' resignation for what I called a very tasteless remark by Secretary Butts, and I said President Ford made the right decision in accepting the resignation. But I kind of wonder sometimes, and I think my daughter does, and I think many of you do wonder about anyone, whether they're 17 or 52. You can always find fault with everything that someone else does and always make some harsh judgment about you or your friends or your neighbors and say in effect and say publicly, as Governor Carter has, trust me, trust me. Well, I always thought trust was something that had to be earned. And I never really felt we got anywhere in this country by running around cutting up the opposition in those terms on a personal basis. A cheat, a liar, distorting the facts, insensitive, lacking compassion. That's what he said. And he likes to use these buzzwords. When he gave his acceptance speech in New York, he talked about our tax system. He said it was a national disgrace. I'm not so certain I would vary too much from that, but he didn't tell the American people, including those in this audience, that the liberal Democrats have controlled the Congress for the past 22 years. Hadn't been Bob Dole's party or Bill Wampler's party. He didn't tell you the Democrats have controlled the Congress 40 out of the last 44 years. But you may have watched that speech. You may have listened to that speech, and he talked about the rich. It's always easy when you want to go somewhere in politics to go out and attack the rich. That's always somebody next door who has a second car or the second horse or the second anything. He's rich. And Governor Carter knows that. He knows where the politics are. Go out and attack the rich and attack the oil industry and attack the fat cats and attack all those who take advantage, as he said so many times, of tax loopholes. Loopholes is the word he used. So after he said on television about our tax system being a disgrace, 8 days later, he went to New York, a little club called Club 21. Not quite like McDonald's. And he had a little meeting there with small businessmen. Henry Ford and some others showed up. Just some of these average Americans that Governor Carter always talks about, the poor and the downtrodden. And there he was. And After he talked about the loopholes and the rich and all these tax inequities, he said to Henry Ford and the other small businessmen, "Don't worry about a thing. It's going to be a year before I get around to doing anything in taxes." Then he goes from there to some other place and stands up before an audience as he would stand here if he were here, and posturize and moralize and agonize about the rich and about his concern for leadership and his vision for America and how the average American has been led down the path and how the poor American has been maltreated, mistreated, or not treated at all. And he would discuss these horrible loopholes, but he would stop short. He wouldn't tell you about his 1975 tax return, and this is public information. His tax liability was $58,000. That's what he would have paid. Had there not been a little, well, I'll call it incentive. He would have called it a loophole, but since he used it, I'm certain he wouldn't want me to call it a loophole. It's called the investment tax credit. Now, he bought some new peanut machinery. He's going to need it after January. And under the law, you're entitled to take an investment tax credit of 10% of the value of that machinery in any given year. Pretty good chunk of machinery. Must have been $400,000+ worth. So he took $41,000 off his income tax. Instead of sending the Treasury a check for $58,000, he sent the Treasury a check for $17,000. Now, I favor the investment tax credit. It stimulates the economy. It helps business. And when he was asked about this, that's why our tax laws ought to be reformed. That was his answer. That was his answer, not mine. I don't have any investment tax credits. I don't have any machinery to make peanuts or peanut butter or any other thing. And so I just suggest to an audience that I believe is concerned about hypocrisy and openness and candor, take a look at the candidates. This is also a man who's pretty much the candidate of organized labor. I think the American working man and women, whether they belong to a labor union or not, are concerned about spending, concerned about taxes. They're concerned about the right to work without belonging to a union. They're concerned about gun control. They're concerned about Senator Mondale, the very liberal running mate of Governor Carter. They're concerned about why should Governor Carter, if he says he's a conservative in the South, get the endorsement of the New York Liberal Party. That doesn't quite add up to many people. How can he be a conservative, as he says he is in the South, and be endorsed by the New York Liberal Party? It's pretty hard to do. But you can do it if you're not a conservative, and he's not. And he's indicated that, and he's demonstrated that. Sometimes you wonder if he has any position at all. So I just say that when Governor Carter gives interviews, as he did to Associated Press, and he said anybody, any family above the median income ought to have a tax increase, he's talking about many of your families. They're not the rich. Because the median income for an American family where the husband's working and the wife is working, and yes, the children are working, is $14,000. That's what it is. He said he didn't mean that. He said we distorted the facts. Said he left out some words. Senator Mondale said he meant everybody with above $50,000 in income. That's not what he said. That's not what he said. He also said in that same interview that most Americans didn't want their taxes lowered. Now, we've been trying to find anybody who fit that category. We have a doctor with us who'd be glad to look you over if you hold up your hand. Because I think most Americans are concerned about taxes. They're concerned about spending. And if any one group ought to be concerned about our national debt and how it goes up and up and up, it ought to be the young people of America. And If there's ever a reason for young people to become concerned and interested in government and in candidates for the highest office, it ought to be young Americans. And just let me say in closing that I'll admit I have a bias. I've figured out that if Ford's elected, I'm going to make it. And I figured all that out the past 5 weeks. And I've been pretty much on the campaign trail while President Ford has been the president, as he should be. And we've talked to different groups, different philosophies, different ideas, different concerns. Because I think we're concerned about America. And it's one thing to go around the country saying how bad it is. One thing to point up all our faults, and we have faults, don't misunderstand me. But oh, how refreshing it is, and how refreshing it would be if the American people and the leaders of America would stand up and say what's right with America, because we are the greatest country on the face of the earth, and because we do have freedom in America. And that's really what it's all about. And I say to my friends, if you want a liberal ticket, you've got a choice. You can vote for Governor Carter and Walter Mondale. Or you can vote for the Carter-Meany ticket. Either way, I think Meany's sort of a stand-in. Someone asked George Meany why he didn't run for president. He said, why step down?